Good afternoon. This is the LaRouche Show. I am Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm economics co-editor for the Executive Intelligence Review News Service, and I'll moderate today. We are happy to have as a guest Harley Schlanger, who's on the line directly from Los Angeles from our studio there. And I know with him is another guest that will be coming on in a little bit, Quincy O'Neill. Hi, Harley.
Hello, Marcia. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks. I think things are pretty exciting. And so I'm going to say very little. I have a couple things, and I want to turn it over to you, Harley. What I do want to say is Harley will be on for the whole hour with us. And I encourage people to send emails for those on the Internet. For those listening in on the conference call, do line up your questions. We will be getting to you very shortly after Harley's opening remarks. And I think many of you know that Harley Schlanger is our Houston Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review News Service. He's been that for many years. Spends a lot of time in Texas as well as California, Mexico, and other Western locations. Today we especially have him on because he's the campaign representative for Lyndon LaRouche. Now, I know Lynn has been extremely busy. We've had electronic emails and computer messages from him today. He's been in meetings. He's been writing. He's been corresponding. But, Harley, we're glad to have you on in your own right. And I want to turn it right over to you to make some opening remarks, and I'll give out the phone numbers where people can call in and talk with you later, because a week from now, it'll be after the Tuesday, November 5th elections, and things will be very different. Just take it away, Harley.
Well, you're absolutely right. Lynn has been in a very extensive, heavy schedule because of the November 5th elections. In fact, over the next couple of days, he's going to be addressing very significant youth movement conferences. We have a Northeast Corridor Youth Movement conference going on right as we're speaking. And he's going to be addressing that. Last week, he addressed a conference we had up in Seattle. So one of the things he's been stressing is the importance of this youth movement, the LaRouche youth movement, because as most people can see, if you leave it to the existing leadership of the Democrat and Republican parties, there's no future. And in fact, he's just written a new paper called The Next Generation, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm sure it will be quite interesting, which addresses this very question. What Lynn has said is that the election period, the pre-period, is extremely important for putting forward an alternative to what otherwise is war, terrorism, and depression. And so we've been mobilizing internationally, but especially in the United States, to get out several million copies of a new leaflet, which Lynn wrote, called What You Must Do About the Economy Now. And the subhead is The Ever More Electable LaRouche Tells You What to Do About the Economy. And we've been getting this out. We've been hitting campaign events all over the country because what's going to happen on November 5th is we're going to be in a new situation. It's going to be an unpredictable situation. Nobody can really tell what the turnout will be. And I can talk a little more about this later, but in California, the Democrats are very nervous because they've run a terrible campaign for governor. They're running against one of the worst Republican candidates I've ever seen, and nobody's sure if anyone's going to turn out to vote. So in this context, Lynn knows, Mr. LaRouche knows that what he says and does is being listened to by people all over the world, and especially people in political leadership positions in the United States.
Well, you mentioned about California. You also have on the ballot there and in other places even referenda, right? I think there's something like a record number of referenda for $40 billion worth of funding for different reasons, transportation and other things, even though states are plunging into budget gaps and debt. What we're going to do, folks listening on the conference call or on the internet, we've had some interference with our connection with our guest, Harley Schlanger, with whom we were speaking out. He's in Los Angeles, California, in our studio. So while we get him back on the line, I'll continue this point about the elections that Harley Schlanger was talking about, that it's a question mark what will happen on Tuesday in the way that people who go to the polls or don't go to the polls might express their view that the economy's in trouble, that they don't like the war. Some may vote against the incumbent. Some may choose not to vote at all. This is what makes it a big question mark. And one thing that underscores all of this is that, as I was just saying, in terms of the economy, on the ballot is practically a record amount of dollar value of bond issues and other kinds of referenda in different states to fund projects when state revenues themselves are collapsing. We have a budget gap. So that's another big turnoff where the public is saying this whole thing is crazy. Harley, I think you're back on the line in Los Angeles.
Yes, I'm here.
So do you want to continue on this? I was just carrying on
sure,
a bit.
Sure, sure. Let me get right to the point. The problem is that the whole financial system is crashing. There's not any bank that's safe in the United States or in the world. The stock markets have been going up based on a complete fraud that's being pulled off by Alan Greenspan to help the Bush administration. But the reality is that there are massive layoffs in manufacturing and basic industry. It's hitting the service sector as well. The computer chip sector is collapsing. The what we're seeing in the stock market is the effect of a cosmetic effort to convince people that the economy really is okay. But the average person in Main Street knows that the physical economy is disappearing. The airline sector is going to be gone soon. We see US Air, United, American, US Air is already in bankruptcy. The others are heading there. The auto companies, they're giving away cars. And of course, now they're surprised to find out that they're losing money when they have 0% interest, 0% down, no payments for 6 months. The only thing holding it up is the housing sector, and there are signs that that's going to go. Now, in that context, with everything falling apart, we find that the U.S. government is running a $250 billion deficit, and California, which has a $24 billion deficit this year, is now projecting a possible $20 billion on top of that next year. So everywhere you turn, the ability of the population to have any sustained standard of living has collapsed. Governments don't know what to do. And so it's in that context that you see this population listening to the president talking about war, 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 war. And they're throwing up their hands and saying, where is the opposition? Where is their leadership?
Now, just to underscore that, I would like to mention to people, and then get back to you, Harley, the figures from the EIR economics staff today on this degree of unemployment. You mentioned different sectors like the transportation sector, the airlines, and so forth. We have about 131 million jobs in our nation officially, all right? But every month we're posting those jobs disappearing. Put it this way, of those 131 million, a couple of years ago, 18 or 20 million of those were in the manufacturing sector. That's factories and assembly lines. Well, over the last 24 to 26 months, we've lost a couple of million of those jobs, just gone, vaporized. And so we're down to maybe 16 million jobs in the manufacturing sector. And if you look at the actual production line jobs, we have maybe only 11 million of those. So in other words, these sound like just numbers. But in fact, it means that with all the headlines of the shutdowns of factories, there's fewer and fewer people working and in basic manufacturing. So that just underscores the kind of thing you're saying.
Yeah, they're not numbers if you go to the towns where these layoffs are occurring. You look at the area around Detroit, of the formerly industrialized state of Michigan, and you find that the auto plants and the machine tool sector that fed them has been devastated. You take the old steel belt, which you know very well, the Pittsburgh area, western Pennsylvania, eastern and northeastern Ohio, Buffalo, New York. These sectors have been devastated. Then you look at the so-called new economy, the Silicon Valley in California, complete wasteland right now. So you look in the towns where these businesses once were. You take Houston, where I spend a lot of time. In the city of Houston, Compaq Computers is gone. The space sector, the aerospace sector, has been hit very hard. The oil equipment sector has been hit hard. And then you add to that the Continental Airlines, and what you see is that city after city is dealing with the problem of losing jobs, losing health care capabilities. In Los Angeles County, there used to be 23 trauma centers. Now there are 12, and it's expected to go to 8 after the county budget cuts are finalized in the next weeks. So this is how you begin to see the collapse of an economy. One day you go to a hospital and you find out the hospital's closed. You take your child in Washington, D.C. for a flu shot, and you find out that there's a fancy hotel where there used to be D.C. General Hospital. Now, people don't always equate that with a physical collapse of the economy, but that's in fact what's happened. And if there were leaders in the Democratic and Republican Party, they would be telling the American people, you have to shape up so that we can get policy changes going. But there's only one person who's saying that, and that's Lyndon LaRouche. And that's why we're beginning to see what Lynn has been saying all along, that we will have the potential to move people because there will be an explosive reaction to the non-action on behalf of leaders. The only question is, will the American people respond to that call, or will they tragically continue to cling to this bankrupt, useless leadership we've got now?
Well, I'll throw one factoid in here for you, Harley. As some people on the LaRouche show know, and people on the conference call, there are candidates associated with Lyndon LaRouche's economic recovery drive that will be on the ballot. There's Carrie Lowry in Michigan. There's Laurie Dobson in Connecticut. Here in Virginia, where our studio is, for federal Senate is Nancy Spanos, and she's running against the incumbent Senator John Warner, the Republican. Well, this a few days ago at the University of Virginia, which has thousands of students, at their election, Harley?
Yes.
And Spanos polled 20%. It would have been yet more. That's significant. But there was a joke candidate put up to try and prevent her vote. He's a guy who's in the Libertarian Party standing for scuba diving and no government. That's his policy.
The joke candidate, you don't mean Senator Warner, do you?
I could get to him. But anyway, the double-digit vote where there is a vote, where people decide to go out, in this case it was on a college campus, University of Virginia. But I think that's indicative of the mood shift in the country.
Well, Marcia, one other thing on this mood shift. There was a very interesting article that I brought up with Mr. LaRouche, and he was quite interested in this analysis. In the Los Angeles Times, there was an article which talked about what it called a generational schism, and it identified several different cases. For example, in Minnesota, after the tragic passing of Senator Wellstone, the person who was chosen to replace him was Walter Mondale, who's 74 years old. Now, in New Jersey, where Torricelli bowed out, he was replaced by Senator Lautenberg, who's 78 years old. And the article made this point that it appears after the Bush and Clinton elections that the baby boomers have failed as leaders, including in the Senate, not just in the executive. And the article went on to say that the 20-somethings don't appear to have encouraged a sense of confidence much more because of the dot-com bust and the go-go 90s bust. So what they're looking for is experienced leadership, World War II veterans. And I think in that case, you begin to see some of the lessons that LaRouche has been talking about, the failure of this generation because of the consumerism, the me, me, me mentality. Under those conditions, people are looking for new leadership. And so you begin to see the potential for the LaRouche in 2004 campaign from that.
Yes, we could throw into what you just said the role of Senator Robert Byrd, the West Virginia senior senator, who spoke out against the resolution for war on Iraq.
Absolutely.
And I think he's in his mid-80s, and he's also been acting in the direction of infrastructure. If there was a national constituency mobilization, which LaRouche is building, Senator Byrd from West Virginia has been on that side when it comes to who's going to favor it or not.
Well, I can give you another example here in California. A very prominent leader from the 70s and 80s, Mervyn Dimeley, who was a the lieutenant governor in the 70s, and then he was the head of the Black Caucus in Congress in the 80s. After a 10-year absence from politics, he's running for the California State Assembly because he said we need to reverse deregulation, we need to move back to a policy of infrastructure and jobs. And so he's very disappointed with the existing government, and this is exactly the kind of thing we're seeing.
I will point out to people listening in on the LaRouche show or the conference call that 2 days ago, the Executive Intelligence Review News Service did put out a new special report. It's over 80 pages long, and it is on infrastructure. It features LaRouche's paper, Science and Infrastructure, and it features what LaRouche says can and must be done to revive the U.S. economy. It's full of maps, illustrations, where the railroad was taken out, where the railroads in North America and internationally should be built. And those on the internet site know you can see a notice and where you can get that. Otherwise, people should know to call EIR at 1-888-347-3258. But that's a new report. And speaking of post-November 5th, it's a must-have kind of thing. Harley, you have proposals in California and Texas, and there's also publicity in Mexico, for example, for regional high-speed rail. Is that right?
Yes, in California, the governor did one thing that I think is noteworthy, which is he did propose to have a study of a high-speed rail system that would link up the San Francisco Bay Area with Los Angeles. Now, of course, the original proposal for high-speed rail for California, which is sort of typical of the post-industrial society, was to run from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. But I'm glad to see that they're now shifting the idea of linking up the major urban centers. In Texas, it's an idea that's been long floated by a friend of yours, Hal Cooper, to have a system that connects San Antonio, Dallas, and Houston with a side route through Austin, the state capital. So these are proposals that are on the books, but it's woefully inadequate because you can't do these things on a state basis. As you pointed out earlier, there's no funding, and there's no potential funding unless you have a shift nationally, and in fact, internationally. And this is where you see the political leadership in Washington having dropped the ball to the extent that anyone ever had it. And also what should give people some hope is that we're seeing some developments internationally, which we can get to during the course of this show, in Brazil, where there was a rejection of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. In Italy, where there's an endorsement of LaRouche's policy for a new Bretton Woods. And with the recent trip of the Saudi prince to Russia, the Prince Turki, who made a proposal for possibly a large-scale investment of Saudi funds into Russia to help industrialize that economy. So we're seeing this potential internationally. In the United States, it's only the LaRouche leadership that's bringing this up. I think people would pick up on it, some of the legislators, Congress, and others. Lynn has said that there are some Republicans and Democrats who are decent, but they need the leadership. They need the kick from the top. And unfortunately, we have a president who's being whipped into a war by a bunch of lunatics, the Chicken Hawk faction of Richard Pearl and Wolfowitz and others. And instead of building nations, they want to destroy nations.
Well, on those latter no-goodniks, you described the Chicken Hawks and so forth. Do you want to say anything that you and Lyndon LaRouche are taking note of in the way of what this gang is up to? They have some new secret intelligence, kind of black operations.
Oh, this is quite an interesting story. It would be laughable if it weren't so dangerous. You have poor old Rumsfeld, who decided that he can't trust the military officers or the CIA or the State Department, so he's setting up his own defense department within the Defense Department, which is the civilians. And by the way, the reason we call them Chicken Hawks is that most of them, Wolfowitz, Pearl, and others, are people who were draft dodgers when it was their time to serve the nation. And now, as civilian leaders, they're prepared to send young men to be killed and to kill without even thinking it through. And you have opposition, some opposition in the military, in some cases significant opposition, to their utopian schemes. So Rumsfeld doesn't like the fact that the generals may not want to fight the war. So he's got a civilian grouping preparing the war. he now says that he doesn't like the fact that the CIA can't find connections between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, so he's setting up his own internal CIA, and apparently he's setting up his own State Department to do the manipulations. So you begin to see a pattern that we saw before not too long ago associated with the senior Bush. That is a return to the policy of Iran-Contra, where you have dirty operations being run from the basement of the White House, while the above-seen idea seems to be, well, this is really something that we're not involved in. So that's why they call it dirty operations or black bag jobs or things of that sort. But it's very dangerous because it's run by unelectable officials who are committed to a policy that goes against the traditions of our nation.
So it's like Iran-Contra dirty operations take two, you're saying. And in that sense, some of the networks around the country that might have otherwise be able to be mobilized to do something decent about the economy or decent about foreign policy or certainly military policy. Do you want to say anything about what you or Linda LaRouche is saying about the Mooney factor?
Well, this again takes us right back into Iran-Contra and dirty operations. We've just published in the Executive Intelligence Review the first of what I think will be a series of articles on what is a dirty foreign intelligence operation run through this crackpot Reverend Moon, who advertises himself as the second coming of Jesus Christ, only he's the earthly Jesus. I mean, some of the things you read from him are quite bizarre, and I'm glad to see we're including some of that in our EIR coverage. It may not be suitable for family reading, Marcia, but at least it's important that people get a sense of the actual perverse nature of this. What do you find with Reverend Moon? On the one hand, he's working with Minister Louis Farrakhan and promoting the idea of reparations, family values in the among the black Muslims in the United States. On the other hand, he's embracing and bailing out Reverend Jerry Falwell, who recently on national television called the Prophet Muhammad a terrorist. Now, obviously, this is one case where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And so by putting this out, what we're showing is that you have a political operation, which includes the ownership of the Washington Times, the second largest paper in the nation's capital. It includes various other kinds of operations into ministerial associations in the black churches now, trying to win people over to support this policy, the faith-based initiative, and so on. So what we see is an overall attack on the central themes of our nation, the themes of economic development, the themes of fighting for peace, fighting for nation building, as opposed to some idea of an imperial world. And it's really, when you talk about strange bedfellows, imagine Louis Farrakhan, Jerry Falwell, and Reverend Moon in the same bed. And now you see why I say it's not appropriate for real family values.
And the interconnections of this dirty money that you're describing as being thrown around go right into organized crime, Asian organized crime, narco dollars.
Drugs, prostitution, money laundering. There should be a full investigation. Lyndon LaRouche has called for a full investigation into this Mooney operation, which has quite an impact on shaping policy inside Washington. They've got cash coming out of their ears. They're going to black churches with Rolex watches and women. I mean, it's really quite shocking. But then you realize that we're living in a society which is moving into a dark age. And so you begin to see that maybe you can buy off people with Rolex watches and women and things of this sort. But, yeah, we'll have the whole dossier. It's there in the Executive Intelligence Review. It really is what we call the dark side of the moon.
And I understand in Japan there's a court order just in recent days for an investigation and you could call it deprogramming of some of the Reverend Moon Mooney connections into organized crime. And Brazil, there's an investigation into money laundering by the Moonies.
Well, it should be noted also that our former president, George Bush Sr., had barely been out of office then he went and received $250,000 from Reverend Moon to appear with him in Buenos Aires, Argentina, to launch the Spanish language Mooney newspaper. So this stretches up to very high places. Once again, by finding former President Bush involved, we go back to the Iran-Contra period, where this was the network involved in something called Khalsa, which was the so-called anti-communist, the World Anti-Communist League, which was bringing in funds illegally for the Contras, who had been dope pushers in Nicaragua. It was funding the Contras through sale of cocaine in the United States by networks associated with then Vice President Bush and his sidekick, Oliver North. So this is where you begin to see the murky underworld, not just of organized crime, but stretching all the way up into the basement of the White House.
Well, one of the elements of the dossier you mentioned on exposing this dark side of the moon has been put together today. It'll be appearing on this site on LaRouchePub.com. Is about the bank in Uruguay that the Reverend Moon Group bought in 1973. It's in Montevideo, the Banco de Credito. But in 1996, around the time, Harley, that the first President Bush was speaking in Argentina, it came to pass in November that month that to this bank in Montevideo, 4,000 Japanese women came with about $25,000 each in suitcases and deposited something like $80 million in cash in this bank. This has all come out in recent years. So the very kind of thing you're talking about is recorded, it's dramatic, and I think for all of us on the conference call or organizers in North America to get out the real nature of this can help relieve people of just going along to get along with some of this Rolex and Mooney and pretty girl money.
Well, I think we have to do two things on this. One is that we really do have to get these dossiers out and the story out. But the other thing is that everyone who is in any way associated with our movement really needs to mobilize between now and Tuesday to get out the infrastructure leaflet that Lyndon LaRouche has drafted on how we can turn the economy around, and also the two pamphlets, one on an alternative national security doctrine to the psychotic preemptive strike doctrine that's been adopted by the Bush administration. That one's called A Boldly Modest U.S. Global Mission. And the other pamphlet on the infrastructure programs, the LaRouche November program to rebuild the economy. And Marsh, I have with me in Los Angeles one of the leaders of the LaRouche youth movement who I'd like to have him say a couple words about what we've been doing on the campuses to
Right.
get this out.
I think that's Quincy O'Neill, and I want everyone to hold on. I have to make just a very brief announcement. Quincy, just hold on a second. And those who are listening on archive, when that comes to pass, you must stay past these few announcements because this is very important, what this young man's going to say. All I have to say now, thank you, Harley, is that you're on the LaRouche Show live or later on archive, and which occurs every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And anyone listening in who wants to call, not email us, can do it at 1-866-857-4327. That's in the United States, 866-857-4327. If you're listening from abroad, besides emailing, you can call us at U.S. area code, then call the area code 703-443-8419. Otherwise, you know you can reach us by email, and I invite you to do that, and I invite the conference call people to line up your questions, and so that after Quincy speaks, we are going to have a chance to answer those questions. And during the week, or at any time, besides on the www.larouchepub.com, you can call to get the information we're describing, especially this leaflet on infrastructure and global mission. Call 1-888-347-3258. All right, what I'd like now is Harley or Quincy, you can go right ahead.
Well, we have a situation on the campuses that is explosive, to say the least. We have a group of the population that is somewhat removed from population, that is, that they're in college, so they're kind of in a no-man's land, except that they're supposed to be preparing themselves for real life. What they're faced with are these crises. there won't be any jobs. Because people who have jobs lined up, it works out that depending on what line of work you're going to go into, that as early as your sophomore year, you could know whether you'll have a job or not. Those things are going away. Their friends that they spoke to last year that had the investment banking job are now being cleaned out by these major investment banks. And things aren't making sense. And it's very much a situation we had after September 11th, that people have been shocked, but it doesn't come to the surface in obvious ways. And what we've been doing is challenging people to deal with that anxiety, because it's there. They understand there's a crisis going on, and they feel somewhat helpless. Even at the situations where we have debates and rallies, there are people mobilizing against the war. When we go to them with the infrastructure program and LaRusso's analysis, they are sometimes very relieved that we're there, very excited to see us and want to get involved. And other times, they're a little afraid. But there are people that are trying to do things. And what they're afraid of is being challenged, because they're realizing they're going through a crisis. They figure out that they've been duped. They've been taken. And to start all over again and to take responsibility frightens some of them. But on the other hand, as I said before, it's exciting. People are buzzing around us. We are the discussion on the campuses. No one else is doing anything.
Quincy, thanks. There's an email that came in directly to your point. May I put it to you now, and Harley? It came from Canada. It's from Steve. And the email is this. I'll just read it. If anyone listened to the regular media and the official government statistics, then you think that the number of people losing jobs is not very significant. But people who actually know anything can see many large companies are laying off thousands of people at a time. So my question is what is happening to these people who are losing jobs? Are they getting lower paying jobs at McDonald's? Are they out on the streets? Or have they just been neglected by the government, and are they being removed from the statistics? Thank you. That's from Steve in Canada. Do either one of you want to respond?
I'll just say something briefly on that. The official government statistics, as we've demonstrated over and over and over, are lies and fraud. That you have for unemployment statistics, for example, once you've exhausted your unemployment compensation, you disappear from the statistics. People who are working part-time because they can't find full-time work are counted as employed, but when they're laid off, they don't end up counting anywhere. There are any number of statistical categories in which you become a non-person. And many of these non-people are among the nation's homeless. Then you get people like Rudy Giuliani who start sweeping the homeless off the streets and arrest them. So it's sometimes very difficult to know exactly where these people are going. But, you know, the old joke about a recession is when your neighbor's laid off and a depression is when you're laid off. You also can see this in the sense that you have families coming together, not because of love, but out of necessity. Three generations in a small house. So a lot of this is hidden. It's not hidden to people. There are a lot of people, as Quincy was saying, on the campuses. It's not as though people think they're going to now step into a $100,000 a year job in the dot-com sector. But there's still the illusion. And that's why what we have to do, including the people listening to the call, what we have to do is get out and tell people, don't be ashamed about your circumstances. Go out and organize.
And what Harley said is this idea of someone being a non-person, that's very important for the younger generation, that they get a sense that they are non-persons, that the government policy is not taking their future into account. And so as they're realizing that, and when they come into contact with us, they see that we're serious, and they want to organize. They're coming out with us. We're on the campuses. What we do is we take people from off the campuses, we organize things there, but take them off into the street and have politics in the street, the gauntlet approach that LaRouche has outlined for us, to corner people and say, listen, what are you doing about this crisis? Why haven't you joined LaRouche? But also that what people are kind of, why they're pulling back is because it's frightening. And people are frightened, but we have leadership. We have LaRouche. And if there's one thing about LaRouche that those of us who work with him know, is that the revolution is where he is. And that is the sense that we have to have, that wherever we are in the country, on the campus, on the street, that it is up to us to create this discussion and begin changing people. Wherever you are, whether you're at work, whether you're formally organizing, whether you have a table with you, whether you don't, but that you're the person there that knows that there's leadership out there that's pushing a policy that's going to benefit the world and provide us with a future. And to have the guts to say that and stick to it no matter what happens. And when you try it, it's actually fun because you have people who come up to us and they're upset initially, but then they say, you know what, you guys are exactly right. Or right from the beginning say, you're exactly right, how do I get involved? But it would have never happened had you not have brought it up. And that's the, you know, people are kind of tentative because they're scared. But we should take Linda LaRouche's lead and make wherever you are the revolution.
Thanks, Quincy. And in fact, we have two conference call questions from Western states. This is to Quincy O'Neill, our leader in the LaRouche Youth Movement, and Harley Schlanger, Lyndon LaRouche's campaign representative. He's in the Western states there in the studio in Los Angeles. I'm going to turn to Texas, and I'd like Monroe to throw in his question now to you two.
Okay, my question is, I know LaRouche has come out against the drug legalization efforts many times, and I agree with his stance on you know, psychotropic substances.
All right.
But today in the internal briefing, there was a report on some efforts that are going on in several states, and two of the efforts that were reported were in Washington, D.C. and Ohio, and those were efforts to treat drug users rehabilitation type measures instead of jailing. And I was wondering why that would be looked upon negatively.
Thanks, Monroe. Sorry, it's a little bad connection, but did you hear okay out there?
Yeah, I got the question.
Go right ahead.
Look, the obvious point is that Lyndon LaRouche would never be opposed to treating people who need drugs with rehabilitation. I mean, people who are having problems with drugs with rehabilitation. The problem is that what you have is a whole series of referenda, the purpose of which is to break down the resistance to drug usage. And so what you find is that the sponsors of these proposals, for example, medical marijuana use, or the idea of decriminalizing marijuana and treating it, having people who have drug problems treated, they're trying to break down the overall resistance to the drug traffic and the literally drugs as a war against cognition in the population. And I think the point Lynn has always made on this is that the arguments that are put forward are disingenuous by the people who really support drug legalization. The people behind drug legalization are people like George Soros. Soros doesn't care if people have the freedom to use drugs. Soros is part of a clique that's out to destroy the nation state. Soros comes from this open society idea of Karl Popper, which is part of the whole Frankfurt School and the attack on the idea that there's truth, the idea that nations have to fight for a higher purpose. For Soros, the highest purpose in life is for him to corner a market on something and cheat everyone out of their livelihood. So when you look at these issues and you start getting a little soft and say, well, shouldn't we be doing something for the people who are hooked on drugs? Of course we should. First thing you do is you shut down the drug traffic, and if you really want to do that, what Lyndon LaRouche has always said is you go after the money. You start throwing some of these bankers who launder drug money into jail, the real kingpins. You take people like Oliver North, put him in prison. You take that kind of a step on drug traffic, and then secondly, you have an education process which gives children a sense that their minds are useful for something other than fantasies based on drug usage. And in this sense, I'd like Quincy to say a little something about this problem of giving youth a sense of purpose, getting them out of this idea that there's no future.
Well, it's pessimistic. It's cynical. It's what we've been born into. And the problem is there isn't, there hasn't been leadership, there hasn't been a movement. And when you give people the chance to be optimistic, to say, well, we have a plan, we can do something, you can change the world, you can change the American population, you can implement a policy that will better not only the nation but the world, they respond to it. But in fighting that, what you have to deal with is, well, does that mean that I have to give up my drugs then? Or does that mean that I have to give up my identity as, you know, a yuppie or whatever it may be. But people have to change their identities, and that change is a pregnant moment. So as they're breaking out of it, as long as we're able to be there with the leadership and with the plan, things will work. But it is optimism. It is that's what the campaign is.
Look, we have a good friend who's the Democratic nominee for governor of Nevada, Joe Neal, who accompanied me to Mexico not that long ago to fight to save Mexico's sovereignty from an onslaught of the energy pirates from Dynegy, Enron, Reliant, and others. Joe was one of the leaders in the whole nation as a state senator in Nevada in the fight for re-regulation and for FDR-style infrastructure policies. And Joe, as a candidate for governor in the state of Nevada, took a very strong stand against the marijuana legalization referendum that's on the ballot in Nevada. And Joe correctly identified the Executive Intelligence Review as one of the sources, the only sources, on who's behind this fight. And so the official organization fighting against the legalization of marijuana took the material we had on the role of George Soros, the mega speculator, in his drug advocacy group in financing this legalization process. Now, immediately, the main newspaper in Las Vegas went nuts, and they attacked the person who took the material, they attacked Joe Neal, and of course, look at the source. I mean, the problem we have with Nevada, besides legalized prostitution and legalized gambling, is that now they're going for legalizing marijuana, and for what purpose? This is part of what's destroying the country, the turning of everything into a commodity that can be bought and sold, and the idea of entertainment taking over from production. And so here you have an irony. Joe Neal is running for governor. One of the key planks in his platform is to increase the taxation on the casinos so that you can fund education and you can fund health care. And he's being attacked for that. And Joe Neal also supporting LaRouche's intelligence on the legalization of marijuana, why it shouldn't be done, and he's attacked for that. Now, the question that Joe Neal's campaign poses in Nevada is whether there are some honest people in Nevada who can get to the polls. So the good news is that the polls show that about 2-1 opposition to this legalization measure. So I think Joe's done a very good job on that one, and I think he'd make an excellent governor of Nevada. But it just shows you how these debates get turned into these silly little shouting matches where people obscure the real issues. Now, the other thing I just like to say about Joe Neal in Nevada is that the necessity for this kind of political change, for someone to take a stand, to be unpopular if necessary, that's the key to change. The biggest problem, and we've talked about this a lot, what is leadership? You know, a lot of people think of leadership as something out of Hollywood, like Mel Gibson in Braveheart, you know, the charismatic figure charging up the hill. But in reality, leadership is often someone who's unpopular in the short term because he's pointing out your flaws. He's pointing out to the population that if you continue with these bad habits, being soft on such questions as marijuana legalization, lotteries, these kinds of casinos all over the place, if you try the shortcut so that you don't have to change, your society is doomed. That's what real political leadership is, and then to show an alternative. And that's the difference between Lyndon LaRouche and the LaRouche movement and anything else in the country. And that's why people like Quincy and all of our other younger colleagues out here on the West Coast and on the East Coast, why they're doing such a good job. Because they're going into an environment where people are being told, you want to get a good job, you play by our rules. And they're going in and saying, but your rules are crazy. And they're finding an increasing response from people who recognize that staying with the rules means the death of the nation.
Thank you. And there are, let's go to the question that Harley Schlanger, he's speaking to us from Los Angeles. He's Lyndon LaRouche's campaign representative. The question raised in the previous segment about how a lot of the rest of the world is looking at the United States. They're looking at the LaRouche Youth Movement in particular. And there has been some motion in the Pacific Rim that's very strategically important regarding infrastructure and nation building in terms of the new Korean Peninsula Railroad link-ups, one to Russia, one to China. Harley, do you have anything to say about the politics or the prospects for that and how it's being looked at here in the United States?
Well, if we can stop the chicken hawks from having Bush blow up Iraq and most of the rest of the world, we've got great prospects. I mean, the potential in Korea just gives one indication, where you have the rail connection is being built right now, which will mean that South Korea will cease to be an island cut off from the rest of the world and will be able, through North Korea, to reach markets in Europe and South Asia, the Middle East, and so on. You have similar motion with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which recently had a conference and discussed further not just cooperation against terrorism, but positive economic policies. Remember, not too long ago, Lyndon LaRouche was in Abu Dhabi, where he gave a speech about the Middle East as a crossroads. And now we see this very interesting development I mentioned earlier of the Saudis reaching out to the Russians. And the irony, the special irony here, is that the prince who went to Russia, Prince Turki, for 30 years headed up Saudi intelligence, which means he was the person in Saudi Arabia who was working with the United States to support the Afghan Mujahideen who fought against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Now he's going to Russia and saying to them, let's work together to stop the war against Iraq, to stop the Chechen terrorism, and to rebuild the Russian economy, which was destroyed by the shock therapy free trade after the fall of communism. So the potential for rail, for the corridors of development with agricultural projects, communications, and so on, that were identified by Lyndon LaRouche in the Eurasian land bridge policy, these are all set to go. This would mean millions of jobs worldwide, including in the United States. We could revitalize our machine tool sector. We could revitalize every important sector in addition to having the infrastructure connections. For example, the Eurasian land bridge going through the Bering Strait down the western Canada slope into the western United States, down through Mexico all the way down to the Tierra del Fuego and the southern tip of South America. You could hook up by high-speed rail Europe, Asia, and North and South America. Now, these are projects that could be started immediately. And this is what Quincy's talking about when he says, we're giving hope to young people. Instead of having the idea of controlling your own patch of turf in a ghetto, you actually can be an entry point for goods for all over the world. And so this provides a completely different perspective. So I think the Asian side is moving fairly well. The situation in the Middle East, there's a high appreciation of the work of Lyndon LaRouche, who's quoted just daily in the press, the various press in the Arab world, in South America, in Brazil and Argentina, Mexico. Lyndon LaRouche is a household word, and he's seen as the alternative to the devastating policies of the International Monetary Fund. So if Americans got up on the mountaintop that used to be our privilege, to look at the whole world with the optimism of the American system and say, we can help you solve your problems. If we were to do that again, if we had leadership that inspired us to do that, then we could solve these problems. Now, last week in Seattle, Lynn made a special intervention with the young people. He said, look, your parents are a bunch of old goats sitting around on their butts. They need to be lifted out of those seats. They need a kick in the rear end. They're going to get it from the youth. And so I think it's critical to get the sense of the youth communicating with the World War II generation, their grandparents and great-grandparents, to try to do something with our poor generation, Marcia, the poor, worn-out baby boomers who are just sitting around waiting for senility to dull the pain of having to face a world that seems to have gone out of control. So if we can link this up, maybe we can still salvage something out of our generation.
Well, this is very promising, and I also know people listening or people listening later in the week should know that there have been youth conferences in France recently, one in Breton, and I understand Berlin.
Yeah, Berlin is today.
So that's November 2nd, and here in the East Coast, there are probably over 100 youth in retreat. That is just the way to describe in a conference.
They're not in retreat, I can tell you that.
No, they're leading the advance.
And Marcia, we have the weekend of the 16th and 17th in Los Angeles. For those of you on this call who are really youth, and I mean real youth, or have children and grandchildren that you'd like to get involved with the LaRouche movement, just contact us through the numbers Marcia will give you, and we'd be happy to talk to you.
Yes, I'll repeat those numbers now. We still have a few more minutes, and there are some other questions. But anytime, call this number toll-free inside the United States. You dial 1-888-EIR-3258. That's 1-888-347-3258. About the millions of runs of mass leaflets that we've mentioned during this show, about the infrastructure leaflet, so-called, in other words, what LaRouche says to do about the economy now, and other material, and also about these, especially these youth conferences, currently and upcoming. And otherwise, in the final few minutes, you can still email, or in the United States, you can call 1-866-857-4327. We have had a few questions. I'll direct this to Harley, but Quincy, you can also, I welcome you to speak up. But on the update on the Middle East, Harley, there are headline events about the situation in Israel. And then there's the question of the continuing debate over the intention of the United States in terms of the United Nations Security Council to try and make war in Iraq. Do you want to say anything about that before the show concludes?
Sure. Two quick points. On Iraq, Lyndon LaRouche has been saying that hopefully the Europeans would do something, the French in particular, the Russians, to jam up the war. And I think that we've seen that happen in the UN Security Council. What you see is the pernicious intensity with which the war hawks want this war, that they continue to push and continue to fight. But so far, the French have held up fairly well. In fact, Jacques Chirac nearly engaged in a fistfight with Tony Blair at a recent European Union meeting, so that's something I wouldn't mind seeing. The Germans have continued to put up opposition, the Saudi-Russian discussions. So I think on the war, there's been an effective stalling, at least. But look, that's not going to stop the war. This Chicken Hawk faction is intent on the war. Now, that brings us to Israel, because Sharon also is intent on a war. Now, the Labor Party belatedly, but finally, pulled out of the Sharon government, Ben Eliezer, Shimon Peres, and others. But to show you how dangerous it is, what does Sharon do? He turns around and offers the foreign ministry position to Benjamin Netanyahu, who may be the one person in Israel crazier than Sharon. And so this situation is highly volatile. There's a potential now, though, centered around Yossi Beilin, the old aide to Shimon Peres, and Mitzna, the mayor of Haifa, to pull together perhaps a coalition of the anti-Sharon pro-peace parties to go back to something along the lines of Oslo. As you know, Lyndon LaRouche said that he endorsed heartily the Oslo Accord, especially because it included economic development as a central feature. So it's a highly volatile, dangerous situation. You know, we don't know. Sharon may decide, if the United States won't do it, that he should bomb Iraq. So this is why people have to join with LaRouche today. We have to build an alternative movement in the United States that can direct the policy in Washington. And the way Lyndon LaRouche put it yesterday, someone has to walk into the Oval Office with a group, and this would be nice to include Lyndon LaRouche in this group, and say to Bush, pick yourself up off the floor, Mr. President. We'll save your presidency. We have to clean out the chicken hawks and go with some quite different policies. And it's up to the people who listen to put Lynn in a position to do that.
Thank you. And to underscore what Harley Schlanger was just saying about The volatility, the opportunity, though, that we have if we do everything we can in the United States, take two countries just in the last 48 hours from Europe and their expression of opposition to the United States waging war on Iraq. Germany sent its representative, Joschka Fischer, here to this country, and he met with Colin Powell of the State Department. He met in the United Nations with Kofi Annan, and Germany has said, if you have to, you can use your United States bases still in our nation, but we're not going to have any participation in any war against Iraq. And then over in England, the old banker, Gordon Brown, who hasn't had a record of doing good for mankind, nevertheless said England and the United Kingdom can't afford to get involved in helping any kind of war against Iraq. It can't afford to do anything right now. So you see opposition coming in all kinds of forms against war insanity. So again, we come back to the situation in the United States. We have a closing minute, or minute and a half. If Harley Schlanger or Quincy O'Neill, if you want to say something before we close the Internet The LaRouche Show, you can do so now, and then the conference call people stay on the line.
Well, the youth movement, the youth of the United States, the youth of the world, actually, we would like to have a future. There are other people who aren't youth that would like to have a future. There was a time that I've studied and I've heard of, the period when World War II was being fought, when I understand the nation came together, and people say it hadn't happened in that way for about three and a half years, because there was a mission orientation and there was an evil we had to fight. Well, we're in a situation where Lyndon LaRouche, as a person, as a leader, and as an institution, has given us an opportunity to have a future, and we're responding to that. We can create a situation in which we can organize the population to band together, like in that period, and change the world for the better, and provide a future for anyone.
Thank you. That was Quincy O'Neill from the International and National LaRouche Youth Movement. And we'll now close the LaRouche Show for this week, November 2nd. And we invite you to call in at any time, 1-888-347-3258. And we invite you to listen to the LaRouche Show on the Internet or on the conference call every week. It's Saturdays. It's from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and those of you who are signing off the Internet, we hope to have you next week, and our guest at that time may be Deborah Freeman, also a representative of the LaRouche in 2004 campaign, the Eastern States representative, to look at the situation after the November 5th elections. Thank you all.